unusual show here today on the Sal and Bob Show. We're already, I just started the recorder. Bob didn't even know I started
it. We're still eating.
We're eating chocolate-covered raisins.
And what's the name of this wine? Aveline?
We're having some Aveline.
It's a French wine.
A French wine. It's organic, so we're trying to be healthy and have good wine. And we're getting ready to interview one of the best boxing authors, writers. He's in the Hall of Fame. So
yep.
Nigel Collins will be with us here in a few minutes, and we're just kind of doing our pre-show. We're going to record a little bit after for you folks, but you're going to enjoy a great interview.
Yeah, welcome to the Sal and Bob Show. This is kind of like an inside inside the show thing. We're literally, we hope we're not going to crunch in your ear, but we are still drinking, and we're pre-showing it and talking about Nigel. Nigel is a very interesting dude, one of the premier boxing writers in the world, and a friend of our friend, Mr. Bill Detloff, who's been on the show before, another excellent boxing writer. The two of them together.
Yeah, so we've had two of the premier boxing writers on our show here.
Yeah.
On Sal and Bob Show.
And we're all about sports here on Sal and Bob. Steakhouses, gambling, football, basketball,
football,
hockey,
starting.
Baseball, boxing, everything.
I got my
everything.
Fantasy draft next week.
Oh, you do? That's all. That's right. That's coming up.
Next Tuesday night at 8 o'clock, I have a fantasy draft. I'm excited. I have no idea who is a big player like right now. I know there's a few.
Right.
But for those of you that play fantasy football, it's like you just got to, you know, you got to dive in usually a couple days before and just kind of see who's on what team now because players have moved around. You got to really, you know, study the game to where what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
As far
and
as
it's a
drafting.
Fun thing. It's
yeah, it's fun.
It's a little geeky, but it's for money. So you put in a couple hundred bucks,
the winner gets $1,000 or whatever. Mm-hmm. So anyway, preparing for that. Baseball is coming down to an end here. Tigers, I just was listening to the Tiger games today. They lost 2-1. Just a tough series with Toronto.
And 3-2 last night. They're so close, this
night.
Team,
so
aren't
close.
They?
Exactly. But they've been playing really good baseball, but they only have 30 games left. Doubt if they're going to make the playoffs. Just a quick shout-out before we get this interview going. I want to just my condolences to the families of the brave 13 Marines that lost their life.
My God.
I can't thank those people enough for what they do. It's really, I kind of almost shed a tear the other night, and I don't even know
it's
who
very,
those people are.
It's very moving. It's very affecting to see when we're just trying to get out and get everybody out of harm's way
really
that we lose more troops.
Mm-hmm. And they were in harm's way the whole time, and they still are. Just wish everybody over there a safe return home. And for those 13 soldiers and their families, man, we're grieving with you. I know it's a cliche, but
not
with
us.
Thank you so much.
We've got ties to many, many people in the military. We've both done so many benefits for returning soldiers, wounded soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
Families of those KIA.
You and your sister have a group that is dedicated to that.
And so we have a special fondness, a soft place in our heart for anybody who served our country in that capacity.
And with that, I guess kind of might set up our next episode, but we're going to interview Steve Shmargon, who is a comedian and a Marine who served his country. And we're going to interview him. He's a funny guy, and he'll have a perspective.
Looking forward to that.
Maybe what's going on over there, a little bit of more of a military perspective, if he's got some insight on what those obviously brave 13 soldiers went through and some of the other ones that are coming home, what they went through. So we'll talk to Steve and about his comedy. So it's a good combination because we're all about thanking our troops and we're all about comedy. So we got Steve Shmargon next week, but we got Nigel Collins about to call in here any minute. You're hearing this live on the Sal and Bob Show.
So it's hugely exciting for me to have Nigel Collins on as a guest because anybody who's knows anything about boxing has read Nigel Collins over the decades. He is one of the premier boxing writers of all time.
Seen it all, man.
I remember reading him when I was a young fighter and just thinking, I need to know what Nigel thinks about Tommy Hearns because Tommy was my hero. I need to know what he thinks about Hagler and Leonard and about this fight and that fight. And I loved every month, you know, the Ring magazine coming in and reading those articles. And I'm so proud of my sons, too. I want to dedicate this whole episode to them. My oldest son, Ben, he's a kickboxer. He's been a cage
great
fighter,
kickboxer.
He's just one of the most courageous guys I know. An absolute bomber in the ring, gives his all every time. I mean, he's fought everyone from middleweight to light heavyweight. He just personifies what a fighter needs to be, right? And then my youngest son, Max, he is about ready to take his first fight. And I'm a little worried, as I am worried whenever I watch Ben fight, because they're my sons, right?
Sure, you don't want him to get hurt.
But he's so good. He's so fast. He's so slick. And he's got this beautiful left hook, and he's got a slick right hand and a great jab. And I can't wait to see him in action.
He seems elusive. He seems like you wouldn't be able to hit him.
Yeah, he's there and he's gone. Yeah, yeah, he's like that. He's very fast. He's not like me. I ate three punches to give one. And I just can't wait to see him fight for the first time. And I'm so proud of my sons, and I'm dedicating this episode of Sal and Bob to them.
That's awesome. Well, Ben and Max are great guys. I know they're your sons. I'm being biased, but they're really, really good guys.
Thank you, Sal.
I really enjoy talking to
both of
them.
And they think the same of you, my friend.
Yeah, and likewise. So, that's a pretty good company to dedicate this to them.
Yeah,
this
and here's
a great interview.
Thank you. And here's our episode, or our interview with Nigel Collins. Hey, Nigel.
I hear one person. You hear me?
Yeah.
I hear you, Nigel. This is Sal D'Amelio. It's a pleasure to meet you, man.
Yeah, well, that's, I'll tell you, I never heard of you guys until this week. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay.
That's okay. That's all right. We're the underground podcast. Nobody knows of us. We're really good.
You are a most welcome guest. I want to tell you a couple of the reasons why. We have a mutual friend in Bill Detloff.
Oh, yeah, yeah. We've been, Bill used to work for me for years.
Yes.
He was, a contributor to The Ring, and now he's my editor. So how about that for a turnaround?
Yeah, that's great. And we got to know Bill. He's been on the show before, and he was a former amateur boxer, as was I. I was a Golden Glover, and I've been a boxing fan all my life. And I read you religiously over the years in Ring Magazine, now in Ringside Seat Magazine. And
how did you get Ringside Seat? That's really a special publication.
It really is. It's a great publication. And you can tell that it's written by and run by fans and experts in the sport.
Yeah, it was really a strange thing. We're into our fourth year now. And Michael Cronenberg, whose magazine it is, had a meeting with me and another fellow. And I was the most pessimistic of the three. I was really thinking it wouldn't be here 4 years after we started. But it's catching on with people who like, good boxing writing. And the graphics are fantastic.
Yes,
it's
a good-looking magazine. It really is, and it feels good when you read it. When you're holding something in print, because everything's online
it's
these
a beautiful
days.
Book, man.
Yeah, we found out that obviously digital is what really is keeping everything alive now. But there's still a lot of people out there that like a paper magazine. So we released it digital, and a week later, then they can buy the paper version from Amazon. So that's worked out well for us. I was surprised at that, too. I guess there's a lot of old people that like to read magazines.
Like me.
We can capture all demographics with having both.
Well, you do a great job with that, Nigel, and you've done a great job over the years. You've been my favorite boxing writer. I remember being 19. I fought from when I was 19 until I believe I was 23, and just decided after my last Golden Gloves fight, which I lost on a split decision, that I was tired of the broken noses and black eyes. But I continued to read you. I continued to read Ring. You were there for a long time. You were inducted into the Boxing Hall of Fame in 2015.
Congratulations.
How did that feel?
That was a great long weekend. I mean, obviously, it's the highest award that anybody involved in boxing can have. So there's that. But you feel like a movie star for 3 or 4 days. It's really amazing. I was sort of in on the beginning of the thing up in Canastota, and it's just grown and grown. And of course, the pandemic has knocked it out for a season, but it's coming back It's. I don't know if either of you guys ever have an opportunity to be there. It's almost surreal. The people who were being inducted have a parade down Main Street in, you know, in convertibles.
Wow, I didn't know that.
When it first started, there was always people along, you know, the route to cheer you on and stuff now. But that, now there's 10 times as many people along the route. It's like, you know, a big occasion in Canastota. So, yeah, that was great. I had my daughter and my grandson with me. My grandson was 16 now, so he was 11 or 12 at the time. He rode in the convertible with me, and he kept saying stuff like, "This is unreal. I can't believe it."
What a proud moment that must have been for you.
Yeah, it was. It was really special. I was voted in the first year I was on the ballot, which is, you know, sort of unusual, but not for the great fighters, but for the boxing writers. But I guess I'm getting old, so that's why it's happening, and all this stuff is happening to me now.
That's great, Nigel. Hey, Sal D'Amelio here. It's again, so nice to talk to you. Now, unlike Bob, I'm not like this great historian, boxing fan. I like the other sports, you know, that I grew up playing, like baseball and football and stuff. So, but I've always enjoyed boxing. It's kind of funny. I feel like I came into the boxing world when I got old enough to know who Rocky Marciano was, just because he was Italian. So it just got me into being a boxing fan when I learned of him as a young, you know, young man. But I want to ask you, what is the first fight you ever went to?
It was a fight in Miami Beach. I was down there between, I guess it was the senior year, I can't remember, the junior year of high school. And we went to see a show at the Miami Beach Convention Hall. And it was Louis Rodriguez, the two-time welterweight champion, fighting a guy called Wilbur Skeeter McClure. And it wasn't that exciting of a fight. But what was exciting is that it was during the preliminaries, and suddenly we were up in the balcony. A lot of the people started moving towards the entrance, and you could see something was going on. So if I leaned way out over the balcony to see, I saw Muhammad Ali there. He was in town training for the first Olympic fight, and he was standing there waving a handful of money, trying to get people to bet against him. And it was, you know, nobody did. Everybody was just having a good time and laughing. And, you know, he was always that way. When he was with the people, he was with the people. So that was really the most exciting thing about the first boxing show I ever attended.
Wow, that is so cool. What a great
memory.
What a memory. That's awesome.
Like I said, Nigel, I go way back with following your writing and stories over the years, you know, through the 80s, 90s. And right up till now. And some of the other writers that I've been familiar with, Steve Farhood, I don't know where he landed. It's been a while since I've read anything by him. But I know that...
What happened to Steve? He's a friend and at one time a colleague. He's been working on Showtime for a long, long time.
Right, yeah, okay.
He's on the... he's the color commentator on their show called Showbox, is where they highlight up and comers, and he's the official scorer for the championship, Showtime Championship Boxing. So he's been there for a long time. He does write occasionally, and he does contribute to Ringside Seat. But when you work in TV, you're making a lot of money, and you probably don't have as much time. But he's a great guy, and he is the person who actually invented KO Magazine.
Right, that's what I remember.
He's very proud of.
Yeah, and I remember there was he had a particular style back then at KO Magazine, where he had this monthly fighters who could fight and fighters who couldn't fight, and it was always like so and so can't fight, but and then he would you know list off some interesting.
Steve's a really good writer. I mean, yeah, even his captions are clever. You know what I mean? He's a clever writer. What he does for Ringside Seat is he has like a top 10 of different things every month. I think it started out with boxing books, venues, all kinds of things. And that's what he does for us at Ringside Seat, and we're lucky to have him. But most of his work now is with television, as it has been for a long time.
Okay, so... You continue to write. I've read some of your recent stuff. I went back and reread some of your older stuff about some of the classic fights that you covered, and remembered your style from. And I mean, like I said, I've been reading you for 40 years, and I always appreciated the. I'm not sure the word. I always appreciated the humanity you brought to your stories. It wasn't about drawing attention to yourself or being overly negative. It was about the story about the fight. It was a story behind the fight sometimes, and I always liked that about you. Tell me about how you cover a fight and how you find the story behind the story.
Okay, I'll try. Let's assume it's a big fight, and it was in, say, Las Vegas or L.A. When I come to the fight originally, like, you know, from the cab drive to the air, to the casino or wherever, something will strike me that first day in town. And I usually dismiss it, say, no, I can come up with something better than that. And it can be a small thing, you know. For instance, I couldn't think of any way to have a special story about the fight between Marvin Hagler and Tommy Hearns, which was probably the best fight I've ever covered.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because we're from Motown.
Yeah, so I got home, because it's a monthly magazine, and I was sitting around watching TV, and there was a commercial that came on, and it was Marvin Hagler, and he was eating a piece of pizza from, you know, some chain. I don't know.
Pizza Hut. It was Pizza Hut.
And he looked up, and he said, I wonder what old what's-his-name is eating tonight. Then he took another bite, and he said, probably soup.
I remember that. I loved that. And I love the fact that
he had conquered Madison Avenue. And then my daughter saw him on Punky Brewster. You know, I mean, he...
Yeah.
And remember, there was a commercial he had for some sort of deodorant. So that was huge for Marvin. It was very near the end of his career, but it threw him into the public spotlight like never before. People who weren't boxing fans suddenly knew who Marvin Hagler was. So I wrapped the story around that.
That's a great angle, Nigel. And I remember that. I remember that commercial. And like I said, being from Motown and leaving that closed circuit telecast and just being heartbroken, just crestfallen, because I thought Tommy had him in that first round.
And that was amazing.
And then I later read that Pizza Hut cut two versions of that. One was with Tommy saying the same lines, but obviously
they had to do that, right?
Yeah. And never saw the light of day because he got knocked out.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. A thing similar to that, but not as big. There have been times when we wanted to put a certain fight on the cover, but we needed the pictures taken beforehand. And so what we did is we had both fighters pose with the belt and, you know, use the one that won. So, you know, sometimes you got to think ahead.
Exactly.
Yeah. Once that backfired on us, the belt was stolen. It was a Julio Cesar Chavez fight, and I really can't bring who the opponent was to mind. But they had the press conference and had a picture with, like, you know, a corny stuff where both guys got a piece of the belt between them, sort of holding it. And we had a correspondent there who was taking care of stuff, and after the press conference, it disappeared. It made the newspaper.
The belt disappeared?
It wouldn't have made them if the belt had been stolen. Our correspondent, who was probably semi-responsible, wrote this really funny piece. So, but anyway, you know, we got another belt, and Cesar Chavez got it. So, but yeah, you never know what's going to happen in boxing. It can happen at the weigh-in. It can happen in the ring. It can happen anywhere. You know, it's such a crazy sport.
Isn't that the truth? Wow. That is one of the things I love about boxing: the promotional tours, the weirdness, the sort of, you know, there's in other sports, they never say the underbelly of the sport, but they frequently say the underbelly of boxing, right?
Yeah, we never pretend to be something we're not. I mean, I think, you know, the big networks have tried, and the casinos have tried to put us more or less our corporate image on it, but it doesn't work. You know, it's boxing, and it's never going to change, and I don't think it'll disappear until human nature changes.
Hey, Nigel, Sal here. I got a question, because we have a lot of listeners that are probably not huge, you know, huge boxing fans like you guys are. And we're just talking about the underbelly of boxing. How does, like, here's a question for you that I think a lot of people would be interested in, because I know I am. How does a boxer pick where they're going to train before the fight and the time before the fight? So if the fight is in, whether it's Vegas or a foreign country, when does that boxer go to train for that fight, and who picks where they train at?
Well, we're just supposed that this is, you know, a big fight. A lot of boxers train in their local gym, whatever city they're living in, and then go to the venue or the site a couple of weeks before the fight. I mean, that's very common to do. Some guys, you know, they say they want to train at a higher elevation to give themselves a better shot. You know, they would go up to Big Bear, where they usually have trained in L.A. You know, some people, you know, if it's they go to Puerto Rico. It's there's no rules, just like everything else. And of course, it also depends on where you are in the pecking order, how much money you have to spend. You know, which you know, most of the fighters don't have that enough money to go away to training camp. It's only, you know, the contenders and the champs that have that kind of money in most cases. So a lot of guys, you know, there's two very good unbeaten up-and-coming fighters here in Philadelphia. They both train at the gym in Philadelphia up in the Badlands. So, you know, it's there's no one answer to that. And money plays a role, how much you can budget for, you know, the training camp, because you got to pay your sparring partners, you got to pay your trainer, you know, wherever you're staying, you know, gym time.
So it's the guys, it's a monetary
that are just
thing as
lucky
well.
To be on a card, and you know, they're just going to grind away where they always did.
Sure. Well, this is great. We are here with we're talking right now on our Sal and Bob show with Nigel Collins. We are so happy to have him on here. We're going to talk about a book that he wrote in just a minute, but I want to ask him one more question. What is probably the greatest boxing fight you ever saw, live or on television? What do you think is the best fight ever? I'm sure you've probably written about it, but we're going to ask
our
listeners.
It's hard to pin down. I think I mentioned before, I think the Hagler Hearns fight was the best one I covered live.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've been to a lot of big fights, but there was so much packed into that, you know, less than three rounds of boxing. It was, you know, all the energy was compressed. And, you know, the image of Hagler with the blood running down his face, you know, charging after Tommy Hearns after he hit him with that first right and into the ropes. It was, let me just tell you one little thing about it. I don't do this all the time. I was in the press section, and when that first round ended, there was a nanosecond of silence, and then the place exploded like an atomic bomb had gone off. And I found myself standing on my chair, screaming into a microphone. And I looked around, and there were other people in the press section, either standing up or on their chair. And it was just so exciting that it took you out of your body and you were doing stuff you didn't even realize you were doing. Well, I was. Anyway.
Wow.
I completely
get
what you're talking about. I completely get what you're talking about. And this is not a setup, folks. Nigel said that the most exciting fight he's ever witnessed live is Hagler Hearns. Now, I did not see it live. I saw it on closed circuit. I've been to Vegas. I've seen a lot of fights live. But this was 1985, and I was crestfallen at the result. But yes, I know exactly what you mean, Nigel. There was an electricity. There was an energy. There was a what the hell is going on here? I've never seen any first round like this in my life.
You knew you were watching history. You knew you were watching greatness.
You just knew it. There was something going on you hadn't seen before. They came out and Marvin, you know, I mean, came out with a, he was trying to hit him with an overhand right. Tommy dodged it. And then it was just mayhem. And I remember sitting, I was out of my seat. Everybody was out of their seat within seconds. And nobody sat down for three rounds in this closed circuit venue, which was the theater. And it's, I mean, I'm from Detroit, so you know I followed Tommy. I actually sparred in Kronk back in the early 80s.
And Tommy? So,
no, not with Tommy, no. Not even close. No. I was a junior middleweight, but I was in his weight class, if you can believe that. I was just a Golden Glover, and I went down there for some work before the tournament. And I got my head handed to me. In fact, I'll tell you a story, Nigel. You might appreciate this. The Kronk workout was the thing that every boxer in Michigan wanted to complete, wanted to be a part of. So I got to be a part of that. I went down there to get some sparring work, and they needed extra sparring partners to come in. You know, it was a round robin thing. Everybody, you needed some new blood all the time. You couldn't be sparring with the same people. So I went down there and I was intimidated as hell. I'm a 20-year-old kid and maybe the only white guy in there at that time. Maybe Mickey Ward was there. I don't remember. Or not Mickey Ward, but Mickey Goodwin. I went three rounds and I don't remember his name. I'm sure he doesn't remember mine. But prior to that, we did the famous Kronk workout. And this was 45 minutes of the most grueling calisthenics and push-ups and sit-ups. And they're just I can't even remember all that was involved in it. And at the end of it, I knew that I was going to puke. I knew I was going to throw up. I knew it was over for me. But I said to myself in my head, you just finished the Kronk workout. Well, Prentice Byrd, one of Emmanuel's assistants said, okay, that's it for the warm-up. And I about died. I said, what? I still have to fight someone after this? It was not for everybody.
Yeah.
And so Tommy did that thing every day. Milton McCrory did that every day. Hilmer Ketty. Guys like Lennox Lewis that went under Emmanuel's tutelage did that every day, and that's why they became and stayed champions, right?
Well, you know, I knew of Emmanuel Stewart fairly well, and as good of a boxer he was as nice a guy. He was a sweetheart, and I think like most everybody who knew him or knew of him, I was very upset when he died. I don't think we even knew he was sick until,
right.
Almost it was over. And I remember he was a guy that would go out of his way. I wrote something that he liked, and he'd lost my phone number. So he called a colleague of mine, Eric Raskin, whose number he had, to get a number to call me, which he did at the office, to tell me how much he liked this particular piece. You don't get that in boxing. Whenever I was with him, it was very, very friendly. I just he's one of the good guys and a great trainer because, there's a lot of people that train championship caliber boxers, but they didn't take them from the beginning and guide them to that point. They probably took over for some guy who was in the hometown or something like that. And he could do that, obviously, with the guys from Kronk. He took them from the beginning to the championship, many of them. And afterwards, he became like, a freelance gunslinger, going from guy to guy to guy.
Yeah.
But when Evander Holyfield rots the Reddick bow, Manuel Stewart took him for the rematch, and he won. And there was the same thing with Cesar Chavez, that he could improve almost everybody. And also take them from the beginning.
Yeah, that's a great observation. I mean, my feeling is Lennox Lewis didn't really come into his own until Emmanuel was in his corner.
He was the person that taught extra tall guys how to fight. Before, they were always lumbering idiots, clumsy. And he was the first guy taught how to do it. And after Lennox, it was Vladimir Klitschko that he taught. So that was something he brought to boxing. It was never really there before.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
Guys should fight.
Well, you know what? Listen, you've been a great guest. I so appreciate your knowledge and your insight into this. We're going to give you a chance to talk about your book. Yes. Sal, why don't you announce
Yeah, so anyway, we're obviously, you're a great boxing writer, but you've also written a book called Travels with Mary Jane, Confessions of a 70-Year-Old Stoner. And basically what the book is about is your journey throughout your life, smoking a little bit of the cannabis in these foreign countries.
A little
maybe
bit.
It's Mexico or London. being somebody that has done that once or twice in his life, and now we live in a state where it's legal. tell us a little bit about that, about the book and kind of what it entails.
It's the one thing I'll tell you off the bat, if you ever had a chance to read it, it's true. Some people think that I made this stuff, but I didn't. It starts basically in 1967 with me staying with some friends in London and decided to try to earn some money going to Morocco and smuggling hashish back into London. That's basically the beginning of the book. And it was basically my introduction to the world of being high. And it carries all the way through till about 5 or 6 years ago, with different adventures along the way, Mexico a couple of times. In Europe, we were in Amsterdam, of course, and in Belgium, we were in Bruges. And, I try to weave in a little bit about the culture and the history without trying to be preachy, you know, throughout it, because there's a lot of people that don't really understand some of these places and what they're like. So I also wanted to write a positive book about cannabis. I was, you know, baby boomer, went through the culture counterculture of the late 60s and through much of the 70s. And I just like every kid that got high, we all knew the government was lying. You know what I mean? So still, even though there are many states where, medical marijuana is legal now and the number of states where recreation marijuana is allowed is growing, things are changing. But for a long time in my life, you know, the establishment painted it as the evil weed. You're going, you know, terrible, the gateway to heroin. We all knew it was bullshit, and that's why it never worked. But
right.
Most of the books about taking even recreational drugs are like about, you know, coming back from addiction or bad things happening to you. There's a couple of good books about people being busted doing what I was smuggling. I just wanted to show the other side, how it's enlivened my life, opened my eyes to things I might not have seen before, formed friendships, made adventures. So it's not for everybody. I'm not trying to say it is, but I just wanted a positive book that showed the good side.
Sure.
That's basically my motivation.
No, that's great. It sounds like a great, fun book to read. You can get that book at Amazon, and it's $14.95 on paperback, and it's great. How many different places have you probably gone? I mean, is it something that it's just pretty much Amsterdam and Mexico and stuff, or have you just gone all over with?
Well, there's probably about half a dozen or eight different places within this book. I spent time in Germany, but it didn't really. Well, there is actually some stuff about Germany. I take that back. So you could throw Germany in there. So it's just basically about the places I have been. And I've been some places where, like Jamaica, there's another one, but it's not in the book. So, you know, there are some places I've been where I've indulged that aren't in the book. So if somebody wants to look on Amazon, don't look under it my name. Look under the name of the book, because there's another Nigel Collins. I think he's a poet or something like that.
Yeah, he's a poet or singer or something like that.
Yes, you're right. You're right. Yeah. So for everybody listening, pick up this book. Sounds like a fun book to read. Travels with Mary Jane, Confession of a 70-Year-Old Stoner. That just sounds funny. What do you think about this legalization now? Do you kind of just, are you sitting back saying, hey, it's about time kind of attitude towards it?
Yes, I am. Actually, as you probably know, if you've looked at the book, it was written under a pen name of the Old Head. And that was done because at the time I was working for ESPN. And ESPN is so politically correct. There are certain words you can't even use. Mickey Mouse is very sensitive, you know. So when I stopped working for ESPN, I came out of the closet, so to speak.
Sure.
And for the last year and a half, maybe 2 years, people know it was me that wrote it. It's helped sales a little bit. You know, it's not a huge turnaround, but a noticeable turnaround.
Okay. Well, I'm going to be reading that book in the next couple of days, and I will catch up with you on Twitter or through a phone call to give you my reaction to it. I'm anxious to read it. So if you don't mind, I'd like to wrap this up with, I have a couple of questions for you, and I'm sure you get asked this all the time, just like we asked you, what's the most exciting fight you ever attended? And you answered with the Hearns Hagler fight, which is the most exciting fight I've ever seen too. But what I've always been fascinated with is that there is this continuing debate among boxing fans, particularly with the heavyweight division, although it happens, I think, in every division, but particularly with heavyweights, where, you know, you can go a couple years, a few years, where there isn't a dominant heavyweight, and the perception is that, oh, you know what, this crop of heavyweights, they could never compete with Muhammad Ali, they could never compete with Frazier, they could never compete with Foreman, or maybe it's, you know, these people couldn't deal with Tyson or Holyfield. We're kind of in there now. We've got Tyson Fury as a champ. We've got Anthony Joshua as a champ. You know, the continual division of championships, which is, you know, in boxing, it's the only thing. It's the only sport that's continually happens in. You know, football, you know, there's the Super Bowl and that's it. There's one winner, right? But in your opinion, are we in the heavyweight division now, are we in as good a spot as we have been over the decades? Do we have a lot of talent up there? Are they as good as the ones that we remember from our youths?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's like music. People generally think the music of their youth is the best. My father was a big band guy, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I'm basically roots and early rock and roll and jazz and reggae. Kids today are into something different. They're into rap, you know, and I just think, you know, that's just a personal feeling. You're always going to think that when you're at your best, whether it's the singer or an actor or an athlete, they were the best. I think there's fighters in every generation that could be on top in all the other generations, but they're few. They're the very best of the best. And I also think it's very unfair to compare fighters from different eras. Like, you know, fighters from the 20s wouldn't stand a chance today, even though many of them are in the Hall of Fame and revered. So that's not fair. I don't know as much about other sports, but perhaps it's not fair in other sports, too. But the heavyweight division itself, well, it sort of got bogged down, you know, with the pandemic. We'd have had the third fight between Fury and Wilder. And I'm looking forward to that one.
I am too.
There's always a possibility. I mean, the thing is, it's funny, but Tyson Fury's a pretty crazy guy, but he's very high IQ for boxing.
Yeah.
Because if you remember after the first fight, when he got a draw, probably won every round. He didn't get knocked down in, but he sure got knocked down. He said, I'm not going to fight that way the next time. I'm going to take it to him and knock him out. And he did.
Yeah.
Most people
say,
oh, yeah, right. You know, you're not going to do that. But what he did, I don't know what he's going to do this time, but I think taking it to him is a good idea because the big flaw with Wilder is he can't box fighting. He can't fight backing up.
Yeah. And I, no footwork.
Training films of it, you know, pounding the bag. And yeah, he can punch. He doesn't need that. He needs somebody to teach him how to box and be able to back up without having just somebody chasing you down and pounding the crap out of you. And well, I don't think that's going to happen, but that's what he really needs. The other heavyweights, they're not that interesting. If you remember throughout history, the biggest boxers when they retire, like Ali, said, oh, boxing will disappear. Bullshit, it didn't. Along came Sugar Ray Leonard and all the guys we were just talking about, Hagler, Hearns. Yeah. Yeah. And when Tyson disappeared and stopped boxing, you know, along comes Mayweather, Pacquiao. You know, there's always somebody that's going to come along, whether it's in the heavyweight division or like right now, Canelo. Canelo is the biggest pay-per-view attraction in the world, and he's a super middleweight. So it's boxing that counts. Sure, when there's a dominant heavyweight champion, it's good for the sport. But it doesn't die when there isn't one, because I hope you guys haven't heard the old joke that boxing's been buried so many times, they run out of shovels. And that's pretty much the story.
Yes, I agree. And people love to bury boxing because it's barbaric. It's old school. We don't have any room in our society for that bullshit. This is a reflection of our society, and I love it. I'm a decent human being. I'm sure you are, Sal is, and I love nothing more than a good fight. Yep. I don't want to see anyone get hurt. I want to see a competitive fight, and I want to see the best man win, right?
Yeah, I think, you know, just like I said about cannabis, it's not for everybody, but it's very addictive. Cannabis is not addictive, but I think boxing is. I know so many people are becoming disillusioned at certain points about certain atrocities, whatever. Oh, we're done. But they come back because once it's in your blood, it's hard to shake. And you probably know that from an amateur boxer training at Kronk to talking to me right now.
So I know that you boxed too before you became a writer.
Yeah, I boxed a bit in the Army, taught me lessons.
Yeah.
And, you know, it taught me I shouldn't be a boxer, but it also helped me understand boxers a little bit better than if you haven't boxed. You probably have the same experience.
Exactly. And I think that's why I've appreciated your writing over the years. You come at it in a way that I don't believe I've ever read an article where you've said, I was a boxer, so I understand this. It's just sort of implied, and I kind of knew that about you. And so I've always appreciated that.
The older I get, and you know, the longer I've been involved in this sport, I do find that talking about my experiences, I do more of that now, because there's so many of them, than I did in the past. Like, I just wrote a piece for Ringside Seat. Bill loves it. It's called 10% Off the Top. And that was when I was a front man managing boxers back in the in the 70s. So that was something that a lot of people didn't know about me. You know, the people that were around at the time, obviously, but that was a long time ago. So if you get a chance to read that piece, it really shows you the way boxing was back then and how a guy like me who should have never tried it had a lot of adventures.
That's great.
Well, I got one last question for you. One last question. It's a question in two parts. And you don't have to answer the first part, but I want you to answer the second. The first part is, in all the time that you've been covering boxing and all the personalities that you've met, who is your least favorite boxer that you covered?
Well, as a journalist, you often don't feel good about boxers that won't cooperate with you. Okay?
So right.
It's often, you know, laced with the fact that you can't get what you want.
Right.
Mayweather got that way the second half of his career. I mean, he turned from a guy that would come up to the office, be delighted to have his picture taken, to one that, you know, really was very difficult to deal with. On a local basis, there was a light heavyweight, you might remember, Mike Rossman.
Yeah, I remember Mike Rossman. Yeah, the Zion Lion. Is that what he called himself?
He was a thoroughly unlikely individual.
Really? Okay, I didn't know that.
So, you know, those are just two off the top of my head. I don't hate any of them. But, you know, journalists want access. That's it, right? So the guys that give you a hard way to go, you sometimes don't like them very much. But there's very few like that because, you know, even if they are like a jerk at one particular time, you've got to realize that these guys are under tremendous pressure, especially when the money gets big, you know. So that's the first part. What's the second part?
The second part is, who's your favorite boxer you ever covered? And you don't have to, you know, you don't have to give me your first one, the one right off the top of your head, and then some others.
There's only one. Yeah. This is an easy question. And it's not obviously the best boxer I ever covered, but my favorite always and will be until I kick the bucket is Benny Briscoe, the Philadelphia middleweight.
Benny Briscoe?
Yeah.
Now, Hagler fought Benny, didn't he?
He personified Philadelphia. And he hardly ever took a backward step. And he was a puncher. And the city loved him. He drew very large crowds. And I knew him as well. He was just a normal guy outside of the ring. But he was feared. A lot of guys were never the same after Benny fought him.
Wow.
If he got you in the corner, you know, it was all over.
Lights out.
Lights
you ever
out.
Have seen that photograph of his title fight with Monzon? Where Monzon's up
that.
Against the ropes, almost in the fetal position.
Yes.
And then like half a ring away. Well, that was one of the greatest fighters that ever lived, Carlos Monzon. And Benny just didn't. You know, Monzon hugged and held and round-ended, and that was his big shot. But he was a very hard puncher. And later in his career, you're familiar with Georgie Benton, the former middleweight who became a Hall of Fame trainer?
I am.
Yeah, well, Benny had actually stopped him in a fight when Georgie was still fighting. And then later, Georgie became Benny's trainer. And he knew that Benny hadn't got the best of himself, even though it was late in his career. He taught him to use his jab more. Yeah. It helped his balance. And he probably prolonged his time at the top another 5 or 6 years. And Benny was Philadelphia. You know, they once ran an article in the paper about 5 athletes that never got booed in Philadelphia. And I can't remember any of them. I remember one was Tommy McDonald, the football
that
player.
That never got booed.
Wow.
Richie Ashburn, the center fielder for the old Phillies in the 1950s. They were 2 of them. And the other one of the 5 that never got booed was Benny Briscoe. Everybody else got booed, including Tommy Hearns. And if
really?
You want to know
okay.
why he was booed, you're going to have to read that story where I was managing fighters.
Okay, I will read that story. I've had so much fun talking to you, Nigel. Now I don't know why. Perhaps I'm conflating eras here, but did Hagler and Briscoe fight?
Yes, they did. Hagler made his bones in Philly, fighting tough, badass Philly middleweights.
Yeah.
In fact, the only fight that Hagler would in the past agree that he lost, because you know most of this he didn't lose many fights, but you know he felt that he won the ones that he lost decisions, like Ray Leonard or something, was his first fight with Willie the Worm Monroe in Philadelphia.
Right,
covered the fight, and that was you know the one glorious night for Willie the Worm. You know, I mean he got stopped twice in other matches with Hagler. But that night he beat him fair and square, and even Hagler will admit it. So there's a lot of stuff like that.
Nigel, I can't thank you enough. Sal and Bob, we're both so happy that you've come on our show with us. I have been a lifelong fan of yours, of the sport of boxing, all the ins and outs, the underbelly that we discussed a little bit, the joyousness of seeing a huge fight like Hagler-Hearns, the poignancy of seeing fighters that we know and care about win and lose. I can't thank you enough for being on here. Is there anything you want to tell us before we wrap up here?
Not really. Just to tell both Sal and Bob that I've had as much fun as they have. So it's an even deal, and I'm happy to talk to any guys you will time you want to.
We'd love to have you on again. It was a pleasure to meet you, Nigel, and talk to you. This is
It's been great. Really, thank you so much, sir. All right, that concludes our interview with Nigel Collins, and it couldn't have been better for me. This was a big deal for me because you got to remember, I was a 19, 20 year old kid reading his articles about all my heroes, and knowing that he himself was a boxer. And, you know, going into the ring, you know, a week later, armed with some knowledge that I might have gotten from something he'd written. So thank you again, Nigel Collins.
We're going to have him back on because we got so many more questions, not only about boxing, but about his book.
Yeah.
That's very interesting. He's got two different, and I like how he correlated the two. He said something about, you know, boxing is not for everyone, just like cannabis is not for everyone.
Right.
So he kind of correlated those two together. That was pretty cool. Interesting guy. He's seen so many great fighters, which is unbelievable to me. That, you know, it's just, it'd be, for me, like you said, you're a huge boxing fan. It'd be like me interviewing, like, you know, Vince Scully or something.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So,
I'm
a huge baseball fan. But that was great. Man, we hope everybody, as we finish out August here, 2021, going into September, we kind of talked about it on our last episode that it's the kind of the start of the fall, you know, Labor Day kind of brings the end of the summer.
Yeah.
And, you know, school.
And I'm ready for the end of summer. I am so tired of this living on the surface of the sun shit. My God,
well,
it was 94 again today.
Cold. Not cold, but I mean, like next week is in the 70s, which is perfect weather.
Love it.
The kind of the heat is kind of going behind us. We got the fall coming up, college football, wrapping up the baseball, wrapping up golf. By the way, we were talking about your
FanDuel team.
I got my fantasy football draft on Tuesday.
I love FanDuel. That's because I can't stay with the same team throughout 17
weeks. You do that every week, and that's a lot of fun.
I love it
because
I can
start doing
it.
That with you, you know, for $5-$10.
I got a new joke for you, Sal.
Yeah. Cheer it.
I'm a pessimist. My fantasy football team is all punters and one long snapper.
Yeah, you're not going to win many games. I have a new joke. They've got TikTok radio now.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen that. That's great. Now I can just drive in my car and listen to somebody shoving a Coke can up their ass.
TikTok radio without the visuals. But you can hear a Coke can going up someone's ass.
Oh, my God. Hey, thanks for Nigel Collins for being on the Sal and Bob Show. I'm Sal DiMillo. Go to saldimillo.com. If you're in the Fort Wayne area, I'll be at the Fort Wayne Comedy Club Saturday, September 4th. And go to bobphillips.com for all his dates, at Bob the Suit for a great Twitter page. This is our last episode in August of 2021.
Good night,
Thanks
everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Sal and Bob Show.